No Brexit is now more likely than leaving without a deal. That is the warning from the Prime Minister the day before her deal goes before Parliament. Now, yesterday, the Times reported a plot by MPs to allow Parliament to take control of Brexit out of the government's hands. So where next? Is the PM right? Is Theresa May right? Could Brexit be at risk? And is a no deal now off the table? Let's speak to our political correspondent, Enda McLafferty. Good morning to you, Enda.
Morning, Vinny.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us today. Labour say that they will table a motion of no confidence soon in the government's if the government's deal fails. So what could happen next?
Well, Vinny, as for Labour, that has been, of course, in the offing for some time. Jeremy Corbyn has been coming under pressure from the other parties in the opposition benches to press ahead with this particular move. But he knows, and I think the majority feeling around Westminster is that has a little chance of success, because we know that the 10 DUP MPs have already indicated, Nigel Dodds did so again this morning, that they will be supporting the government in any vote that's tabled by Labour by way of no confidence in Theresa May's administration. So that is likely to fail. But nonetheless, Jeremy Corbyn is at the point now where he needs to table that, because he's run out of options in terms of delaying that particular vote. But
he seems reluctant to give
another element.
Yeah, he seems reluctant to give a date as to when he might do that, Enda.
Yes, he said at a time of their choosing is how he phrased it yesterday on the Andrew Marr show. But we are expecting that to happen pretty soon, I think, after this vote tomorrow evening is defeated, because Labour simply can't hold out much longer in terms of getting that on the table. And although it may disappear, it will then, if you like, push many within the Labour camp to start agitating for the another referendum, the people's vote as it has been described, because once the general election ask is out of the way, because that has been Jeremy Corbyn and Labour Party policy, that they would seek first a general election, and if that failed, then they would move on to the ground then of seeking another referendum. So that's probably where you'll see Labour ending up towards the end of this week or the beginning of next week.
This government minister warning that there will be a surge in far-right extremism if we don't leave the EU. Is that simply a scare tactic?
Well, you're going to get a lot of this, Vinny, in the run-up to the vote tomorrow evening. We've been seeing it building over the course of the past number of weeks, not least by the activities of some of those outside Westminster. You'll remember, of course, the abuse that was directed at Anna Soubry. We know there's been a lot of hostility in and around the fringes of Westminster, and a lot of people are pointing to that and saying, look, that's what's at stake here. That's the forces that may be unleashed if things don't go according to plan. And you're going to see that raised more and more as we draw closer to the vote tomorrow evening. And you can see Theresa May today again raising the stakes once more, talking about the fact that we're heading for a no Brexit instead of a no deal scenario, because she's trying to reach out to those Brexiteers who so far have said we cannot back your plan, there's not enough in it for us to be able to side with you in this. She's trying to say to them, look, you're going to risk the very real possibility here of this Brexit dream disappearing altogether. And that's what she will be pitching for today when she arrives in Stoke to make that statement. And then we're expecting her as well at 3:30 this afternoon to get to her feet in the House of Commons, Vinny, as well, to repeat that particular message.
Talk me through this EU letter, and that will apparently contain a series of reassurances about the Irish backstop.
Yes, this has been in the making, if you like, over the course of the past number of days, and it's something that Theresa May wanted to put out this afternoon in the Commons, and she will do that about 3:30, where she will say, I have this letter now from the EU Commission, basically setting out where they believe the backstop is not going to be needed or used in the eventuality of how this process pans out. In other words, trying to reassure those MPs that the backstop is, as it has been described, an insurance policy that will only be temporary if it is ever brought into use. And they will try and say that it in no way undermines Northern Ireland's place within the UK. It's no threat to the Good Friday Agreement. So we'll have all that kind of language, if you like, Vinny, tied up in this particular letter. But it won't be enough to satisfy those who are already very uneasy with what Theresa May is putting on the table. Nigel Dodds, for instance, this morning says he's not looking for words of comfort from the EU around this. He's looking for something that has legal standing, text that has legal standing, which, if you like, undermines or eradicates the threat of the backstop as far as he's concerned. And he knows that will not be in this letter, because for that to happen, you're going to have to need the consent of all 27 EU countries. And of course, they've already said the deal is the deal and it's not up for renegotiation. So the comfort letter that will arrive today at Westminster, while Theresa May might flag it up and say it gives all those reassurances that those nervous MPs want around this particular deal, it won't go far enough, because it won't be legally binding.
What about the suggestion of further reassurances from the EU if the Prime Minister does lose this vote?
Well, that's in a sense what we're expecting to happen after tomorrow evening. We're expecting Theresa May to return to Brussels on Wednesday, perhaps Thursday, to speak to her EU colleagues, if you like, to see if there's anything more that she can squeeze out of the negotiation. Because by then, of course, we will be in the scenario whereby her deal has been formally rejected by Westminster. The numbers will not stack up, and she might feel that she'll be in a very different place then, going back to Brussels to say, look, we now know the numbers at Westminster, we now know how many MPs are unhappy with this and how many MPs we need to convince, and that's why she feels that she might be able to squeeze more out of Brussels. But so far, the record shows, Vinnie, and the language out of Brussels is very clear, they are not for turning as far as they're concerned. The deal is the deal, and they're not prepared to reopen it. But Theresa May, of course, will flag up the possibility that we are heading for this no-deal scenario, and that's the kind of language that she hopes may tempt the EU perhaps to have a fresh look at things. But by the no way is that a given, Vinnie, because we know what these negotiations were some way off the 29th of March. And if we get to that particular point, looking over the edge of the cliff at a no-deal scenario, things might change then late in the day. But as I say, that's a number of weeks away before we even get to that particular point in the negotiation.
I know we're talking in hypotheticals here, Enda, but what could they offer? What could the EU offer if she does go back to them, that might sway some people here?
Well, it's very little to see what room they have for manoeuvre, Vinnie, because they have been at pains to rally behind Dublin to say, look, the backstop is in there for a very good reason. We cannot have a withdrawal deal without a backstop. And Theresa May made that very clear at Westminster. Brussels simply will not live with that. So it's very difficult to see what room there is for manoeuvre around the fringes of this deal to try and reassure those MPs. So there's very little chance, I think, of Theresa May, even with a defeated deal, going to Brussels to be able to squeeze any more out of the European Commission in terms of trying to get more latitude and more that she can try and tempt the MPs with. So I can't see it somehow, but who knows, Vinnie, with this process. It's so fluid, you don't know what might be pulled out of the bag to try and ease things for Theresa May. But at this stage in the process, it's very difficult to see where her room for manoeuvre is whenever she returns to Brussels with probably a defeated deal tomorrow night.
Enda McLafferty, thank you very much for your time this morning. Also on the line, we have the Irish News security correspondent, Alison Morris. Good morning to you. Oh, we'll come to Alison shortly. We have the commentator, Nelson McCausland. Good morning to you, Nelson.
Good morning.
The question for you this morning, as you're listening at home, that warning from a government minister that there will be a surge in far-right extremism if we don't leave the EU. Is that something that concerns you? Is it something that you are worried about? 0-30-30-80-55-55, or perhaps you think this is a last-ditch attempt to save the Prime Minister's Brexit deal, some form of scaremongering to try and encourage support for that. That number again, 0-30-30-80-55-55. Nelson, are you concerned?
Well, when I read the report of what he actually said on the BBC website, whilst the headline used the term far-right, his actual statement, as it was in the text of that report, was actually much more nuanced. He spoke there about the example of what is happening with extremism in other countries in Europe, and he said that if there is an outcome which is unacceptable to the majority of people, they might well turn against the political mainstream. He did refer, of course, to a less tolerant society, a more nationalistic nation, but I thought that the references to Europe were particularly interesting in that if we look at Europe, what we have, we see a turning both to the right and to the left in terms of more extreme views. The prime example there is Italy, where you have a coalition government now made up of the Northern League on the right and the Five Star Movement on the left. So it's a more nuanced statement than the headline might have suggested. It's also worth remembering that opposition to EU membership ran across the political spectrum, from UKIP right across to people before profit. So this is not simply a right issue. This is a much more complex issue. Having said all that, I do believe, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, that if there is no Brexit, or there is something that is purported to be a Brexit but isn't really, that there will be a reaction to that. I think people will become disillusioned. They will become disenchanted. It will undermine trust in politics.
What do you mean by reaction? How far could that go?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to understand the disillusionment. David Cameron, on the 10th of November 2015, made a keynote speech to the Royal Institute of International Affairs. This was before the referendum. And this is what he said. It's your decision, not politicians, not Parliament, just you. When the British people speak, their voice will be respected, not ignored. If we vote to leave, we will leave. There will not be another renegotiation and another referendum. You couldn't be clearer than that. But if people in power decide to throw that out and ignore all of that, then I think people will become disillusioned. Some people will come disillusioned and say, well, look, I'll never bother voting again. And we've seen vox pops done by the BBC and others where people have actually said that on the streets of England. What's the point in voting if your vote is ignored? We voted to leave, we're being ignored.
Okay, given the fact, Nelson, that the vote was so tight, the result was quite tight, what do you say then to the millions of people that did vote to remain? Do you just tell them to suck it up, or you know, what kind of response do you give to the people on the other side?
The fact is that we had a referendum. People understood when they went into the referendum the nature of that referendum, or at least they believed they understood it, which was that if there was a majority to leave, then we would leave. And 17.4 million people across the United Kingdom voted to leave. That is the nature of a democratic decision.
OK, let's bring in Phil Kelly from the Labour Party at this point. Good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning, Vinny.
So the rise of the far right, what about the rise of the far left?
Well, I mean, if you look at what's happening in Europe, but also globally, you've seen the collapse of what is often called the political centre. Now, that collapse, that shouldn't necessarily be mourned, because it was that political establishment across Europe, across the world, who were the midwives of the crisis that we now face, which really started in 2008 with the global financial crash. And we are living with the legacy, and Brexit is very much a symptom of that financial crash. So that political centre, that status quo, is not something that we should be fighting to preserve, because it created the conditions which has led to all the problems we're facing.
Okay.
So what you need is a different style of politics, and that's why I would argue that you need a left-wing analysis, a left-wing government, progressive governments, take control and start bringing in the policies that means that those millions of people across Europe who were left behind economically start having the issues that they're facing day and daily addressed properly.
Well, Nelson, would you be in favour of that?
Well, I think we've already seen the rise of the left in that, in Great Britain, the rise of the Momentum movement within the Labour Party, which effectively has taken over the Labour Party. And that's the bulk of the membership. And it's an interesting scenario, because it is a Momentum movement which has huge control within the Labour Party, but is not in step with the traditional Labour support. Because in many of the Labour constituencies in the north of England and the Midlands, we saw people voting to leave the EU. So there's a party there that is deeply divided, just as the Conservative Party is ripping itself asunder at the moment over this issue. There is huge tension within the Labour Party, and I think after the vote tomorrow that we will see an increase in that tension within the Labour Party, because those who have the power, the influence, the Momentum movement that put Jeremy Corbyn into power within Labour, that movement is at odds with the core Labour support, which is opposed to membership of the EU.
Phil Kelly, the Transport Secretary, Chris Grayling, he warned that reversing the decision to leave the EU would open the door to extremist populist political forces of the kind we see in other countries in Europe. It's concerning and worrying for many. You pair that with the fact that the PM is warning that no Brexit is now more likely than leaving without a deal.
Well, it's an astonishing statement from Chris Grayling, and much like when he was responsible for the trains, it's quite late to the party, because he's talking about a surge in right-wing extremism. I'll remind you that during the referendum campaign, a party colleague of mine, Joe Cox, was murdered by a far-right activist, and that the Tory party have been playing dog-whistle politics around immigration and refugees for a very long time. And the Tory-supporting press, if you look over the last 20 decades or two decades, Vinny, you will see headline upon headline which scapegoats migrants, refugees, for the failings of our government. Now, that fed the Brexit narrative. And Brexit, you know, Nelson is right to a degree, and it cut across political lines. But the reality behind Brexit is it was fueled by the right. It was an expression, one, of people like the ERG, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who want a UK that is deregulated, which is a tax haven, which slashes workers' rights. And the only way that they could sell that project to the general populace was to feed a narrative of xenophobia, to play to English nationalism, the rise of that kind of right-wing populism, and really use migrants and other people as scapegoats. And you heard that phrase repeated ad nauseum, we want our country back. But when you start digging into who the we is, you find it's very, very narrow and very insular.
Well, so Nelson McCall and the DUP supported that campaign, so what's your response to that?
Well, I think we've just heard from Phil an example of what was mentioned, in fact, in part of Chris Grayling's speech, or his article in the Daily Mail. He talked there about a nastiness and an unpleasantness in our politics. And it's true that we have seen a more divided politics, a more abrasive politics, more unpleasant politics. But that's a two-way street. I think it's a two-way street in truth. And those who were supporters of the Leave campaign were dubbed as quite often three things. They were old, they were uneducated, and the third thing was that they were xenophobic. That is not the case. Many people simply believe that it is right that our country should retain its sovereignty, and they are opposed to the ultimate goal of the European Union, which, as we've been reminded time and time again, is a United States of Europe. We already have a European anthem, we've got a European flag, we'll have a single European president, there's sort of a European army, there's the Euro, we have also the EU sending ambassadors around the world. All of this is about a political journey which will culminate ultimately, if the Eurocrats in Brussels have their way, it will culminate in the United States of Europe. And that is the primary reason why many people voted to leave the EU.
Sorry, Nelson, you talked about a nastiness in politics there. And what I'm saying is that this Tory government, over nearly 10 years, has been at the forefront of that nastiness. If you look at the Tory party and their allies within the EU Parliament, they are sitting with far-right extremists in there. You'll not forget that David Cameron referred to migrants as a swarm of migrants and accused Jeremy Corbyn of hanging around with a bunch of immigrants. And you'll also be aware that as Home Secretary, Theresa May initiated the hostile environment, which saw vans driving around with, you know, are you in the country illegally? And as Prime Minister pursued that policy, which seen British citizens deported from the country, deprived healthcare in our NHS, that tells you everything you need to know about the horror show of this government. Now, the only way to address that, the only way to get a Brexit that makes sense, that is progressive, is for a Jeremy Corbyn-led government. And that's the only way you'll address with the deep underlying issues that are affecting constituencies in the north of England, in Scotland, here in Northern Ireland. You need that kind of progressive left-wing.
I think it's important to remember that if you had a Tory or a government that was led by Jeremy Corbyn, you have a Labour government which has within it and within that party a strong strain of anti-Semitism. And that I've heard Phil condemn that in the past, the anti-Semitism that is within the Labour Party. So the Labour Party is not the answer to anything. In fact, it would be as damaging and more damaging than any other prospect that I can see. So I think people who are advocates for the Labour Party and members of the Labour Party need to be cautious in what they say in that regard.
Let's take some calls on this morning. John in North Belfast. John, go ahead. Good morning to you.
Right. Phil has to realise this. Tony Blair opened the doors up, and that time he said there'd only be 5,000 Polish people would come into Britain. I'm not against the Poles now, but that's what he said. So you had uncontrolled immigration into Britain. Now, Labour voters...
Uncontrolled immigration, from what do you mean by that, John?
Well, that's what Tony Blair said in Parliament, that only up to 5,000 people from Poland would arrive.
Yes, but you've gone from that to saying uncontrolled immigration. So I'm just wondering.
Then we had uncontrolled immigration in the United Kingdom. And what happened then was Labour voters, not right-wing Nazis, Labour voters in the north of England voted to leave. And the only reason why they voted to leave is because wages was being undercut. Now, that brings on to this new referendum or people's vote that they're calling. Then does that there follow on into a general election where Labour wins and people then can have a right then to protest and organise and say, no, we don't want Labour now after, say, 6 months or a year. We want another general election.
Phil Kelly?
But these Remainers can't have it both ways.
It's always the right of people to protest against the government and call for a replacement government. That's called part of the democratic process, part of your rights. You said there a common myth, which is uncontrolled immigration. There's freedom of movement within the EU, but there are rules that national governments can take to limit numbers. You'll also know that it's not a one-way process. That there's lots of UK citizens working and living throughout the world. But you said another thing, wages undercut. Do not blame Polish builders coming over here or nurses from France or Portugal for the undercutting of wages. There's a reason why wages have been systematically undercut, and that is because government after government have reduced trade union rights. They've reduced the ability of trade unions to represent their members. And, you know, even you mentioned Tony Blair. He didn't do enough to readdress that. In fact, he was part of the problem. So what we need is a Labour government to take power and empower unions to make sure that workers' rights, regardless of where you come from, are the highest that we can deliver.
Just while it's in my head, Phil Kelly, there was some criticism aimed at the Labour Party over the weekend that was accused of failing to condemn activists, a call for Theresa May to shoot herself over the Windrush scandal. I assume you would disassociate yourself from people like that, activists like that.
Absolutely. You know, people use misjudged phrases all the time, and it's entirely inappropriate. I've actually seen in Germany that a big float at a rally where it had Theresa May with a gun in her mouth, you know, as a kind of comic aside, you know, the Brexit process was a national humiliation. But yes, that, no, I agree, language like that is deeply offensive.
Is it fair to say it was a misjudged phrase? You know, it's very direct, it's very specific.
Well, yes, I mean, when you've got mainstream, and this is where I go back to the mainstream media, Vinny, where there's been a continual problem of the undermining of democracy. If you remember those headlines, Crush the Saboteurs, you remember that Supreme Court judges were called traitors of the people. Now, this doesn't, you know, it's not just happening from the grassroots. There is a media campaign which is using violent, provocative language, and that's fueling this kind of divisive conversation around this deep fracture within British politics. And David Cameron, to his credit, with the Brexit referendum, was able to conceive a Gordian knot which is untieable. He's absolutely demolished the British political system in a way that I find it impossible to see how any move forward on the chessboard can lead us anywhere. So the problem here is that you have a media, the tabloid press, drilling in these really aggressive stances.
You're blaming the press for this. Let's go back to Chris Grayling again and his comments saying that this could lead to divisions not seen since the English Civil War.
The divisions are there long before now. Chris Grayling is late to this conclusion. And what I said earlier in your show is that Chris Grayling is part of a political party and a government which has fueled this division, which has pandered to it, which has used dog whistle politics around racism and xenophobia in order to appeal to various different demographics. What you have seen is the UKIP takeover of the Tory party. You know, so there is no need for UKIP anymore or Nigel Farage because the Tories have basically adopted that kind of language and rhetoric, and that's deeply, deeply worrying.
Okay, Stan, good morning to you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Vinny.
Good morning.
I would like to put my point is that in 1998, an All-Ireland referendum was held on the Good Friday Agreement, and the outcome of that was that Northern Ireland constitution couldn't change unless the majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to change it. And the British government have hijacked this and kicked the Good Friday Agreement into touch. And I don't hear many politicians commenting on this.
What do you think should happen next, Dan? What are your concerns?
I have no option, but I think that the people of Ireland voted North and South, that Northern Ireland's constitution couldn't change unless the majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to change it. And the UK government hijacked that by calling a UK election on the EU. The people of Northern Ireland voted to remain.
Well, Nelson, there you go. The Good Friday Agreement has apparently been hijacked.
It has been hijacked. The Good Friday Agreement has been hijacked.
Let's get Nelson McCausland's response to that.
Well, John Bruton seemed to be making that sort of point a few days ago. But the truth of the matter is, when you actually drill down into it and look at it, it has no credibility or substance because the leaving of the European Union would not change in any way the constitution of Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which was the core issue. There's absolutely no connection between the two, and I could understand, I don't know the gentleman who's ringing in, but I could understand why John Bruton was making that argument, because he is a passionate European integrationist and committed to that, and therefore is disappointed and angered that the people of the United Kingdom voted to leave. I think he'd also be concerned because if the United Kingdom, and when the United Kingdom leaves the EU, there will be, over a period of time, implications there for the Irish Republic, because the United Kingdom is such a big market for goods from the Irish Republic.
What you're forgetting is that there's hundreds of thousands of people living in the Republic have an EU passport. Hundreds of thousands of people in Northern Ireland have an EU passport.
Okay, Sam, thank you. Albert and Glen Gormley. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning, Vinny.
Go ahead.
Vinny, just talking about democracy. You know, we always heard in the United Kingdom that we have this great democracy. And many years ago, or over the years, we've basically sent people out to different countries to try and get them to come and have a democracy in their country. But the United Kingdom government cannot bring democracy to the Brexit referendum. And talking about the Belfast Agreement, 20 years ago, there was a vote which I voted against because I didn't believe it was right. But that Belfast Agreement is still there today, implemented because of democracy. As we were told at that time, that 62% of the people voted for it. But when it comes to 17.4% of the people in the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, where is the democracy? And what I believe is, if we don't get Brexit and leave the European Union, you'll have anarchy within the streets of the United Kingdom. And that's the way it's going to be.
And why do you think that?
Well, people who voted basically want their rights respected. If I vote for somebody as an MP or as an MLA or a councillor, it is implemented. And there's no second referendum. There's no ambiguity about the vote. It's taken and it's implemented. And it seems to be that basically, and somebody said about traitors, I believe that the people in the United Kingdom government who will not implement that vote are traitors, because they've been at the European Union and negotiating to stop Brexit. And I believe they're traitors against the people of the United Kingdom.
Vinny, okay. Albert, thank you.
There's a deep issue there, because, you know, I am sceptical about the merits of a second referendum, but we may get there simply because Parliament is stuck. As I mentioned, David Cameron's Gordian knot. There's no way forward. But a second referendum contains huge problems. But when callers say about the will of the people not being listened to, you've got to remember that the majority of people in Scotland voted to remain in the European Union. The majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to remain.
But you know yourself, Phil, this was a UK-wide vote.
Yes,
it was not a vote for Northern Ireland, Scotland, England, Wales.
The follow-on from that, because we're talking about chaos and people protesting, is that a lot of people in Scotland will start looking at the independence referendum again, and also then the conditions for a border poll in Northern Ireland, which I think we would need 10 years at least, suddenly become urgent and it becomes inevitable. So the idea that any which way forward we take does not result in huge upheavals for the United Kingdom, huge transformative change, is naive.
Okay.
Brexit is a massive, massive constitutional change in the United Kingdom, and
can I make two?
No one can predict how it will play out.
Could I make just 2 points, Vinnie, in regard to Westminster? Almost 90% of MPs were elected on manifesto commitments to honour the referendum and leave the EU. What we are seeing is, at the moment, a number of MPs who are passionate Remainers, who in spite of their manifesto commitments, in spite of standing on such party manifestos, are determined now to overturn the will of the majority of people who voted. Now, that's disappointing because it's that sort of... And it's perceived by many people as a sort of globalist elite of arrogant people who have this idea that they know better than the rest of us. Us 17.4 million people who voted were so stupid that they voted for this leave idea because they didn't know any better. And of course, the point about xenophobia is also interesting because it's a point that was touched on a number of times by Phil.
A lot of what you've said there, many would contest. For example, the fact that many people might agree now that they didn't know what they were voting for.
Go back to what we were told before the referendum, and I quoted David Cameron, if we vote to leave, we will leave. There will not be another referendum.
Okay.
Now, could I just make the point? Xenophobia, interesting point, because if that's the case, was Jeremy Corbyn a xenophobe when he was so Eurosceptic and voted against Europe? He was a person who was quite very strongly, along with many other Labour MPs at one time, were strongly opposed to the EU.
Indeed.
So the issue about describing people who are being xenophobes,
it's a completely different argument to argue not to join the European Union as it was then, not to get involved, and that had validity. And Jeremy Corbyn is absolutely Eurosceptic, as I am, but he understood, and that's why he campaigned under a basis of remain and reform, that we are better staying within the EU and being champions of progressive change, because if the EU does not reform, then the EU will disintegrate.
Okay.
I think we see that playing out in front of us.
Phil Kelly and Nelson McCallison, thank you very much.